So this evening I want to explore together one of the central themes of our practice, which is how to learn better to respond skillfully when things are difficult or challenging, when there's something we call dukkha occurring. Dukkha is sometimes translated as suffering, but some kind of reactivity. And having guidance for working skillfully with difficulties is one of the, I would say, one of the glories of our practice. It's, in a sense, it makes difficulty workable, or at least more workable, which is all we can ask, right? And it ties our response to difficulties, large or small, to our deepest aspirations. In other words, it keeps us really connected as we live our lives. And so it's a kind of a safety net, in a way, that as we proceed with the ups and downs, we can stay connected to our deeper aspirations. And I was reflecting, there was an old song by Paul Simon, which talks about some of the difficulties we have in life. I don't know if I'll sing it, but that might induce more dukkha. but there's it's called American Tune. You may know that. It says, "Many the times I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and often felt forsaken, and certainly misused." Sometimes happens. And another verse: "And I don't know a soul who's not been battered. And I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees." Right? So it's pointing out some of those ups and downs. And of course, the teaching is going to be, in part, it's not so much what happens that matters, but how we relate to it. It's always in the relationship to difficulty or pain, ups and downs, as well as how we relate to the positive aspects, that is really crucial. And in fact, some of you know, one of the lesser taught teachings by the Buddha is the teaching of what's called liberative dependent origination, or sometimes called transcendental dependent origination. And as you know, dependent origination, many of you know, is the teaching that came to the Buddha on the night of his awakening. It's a teaching of the 12 links by which dukkha, again, for the time being I'll call it suffering, is made into a habit. It's reinforced. And it's a cyclical, often seen as a cyclical process. The essence of it is grasping or pushing away in a reactive way. That keeps us recycling our habits, we might say our bad habits. And so it's a factor. It starts with ignorance and then goes into habitual tendencies. And then in the moment, let's say we have the habitual tendencies, the ignorance that makes us think that reactively grabbing hold of things to get pleasure or pushing away things to avoid pain is a wise way to proceed. That is based on a certain level of ignorance, and when we follow that, we have certain habitual tendencies which lead us to continue to grasp and push away reactively, and the habits and the ignorance are reinforced. That's a quick version of dependent origination. I could take the whole time to talk about that, and that might not even be adequate. But that's the short version. But there's this interesting teaching called liberative dependent origination, just like a 3 or 4 page discourse. You know, it's not taught very much. And interestingly, this points out a parallel model of 12 factors leading to liberation. And the interesting thing is the two models are connected, But where liberative dependent origination takes off is when the painful and dukkha becomes workable. When we don't simply go in that continual cycle of pushing away the unpleasant, grabbing hold of the pleasant. When we have a different relationship to dukkha, or just, again, let's, I'll call it for the moment suffering, then everything changes. And when we simply try to avoid suffering and get pleasure, that's when things stay the same. When we start to have a wise, compassionate, responsive relationship to what's difficult, the whole of the path starts moving and developing. That's that analysis of that second teaching. So listen carefully. This is where everything opens up. Okay. Another way of seeing it is that when we work with our difficulties, we have the opportunity to see what we might call the various clouds that obscure our deeper nature of love and wisdom. And when we actually work with difficulties in our reactivity, which is not what we signed up for, right? Anyone sign up for, let me learn meditation and just hang out with pain and difficulties and learn from it? Anyone sign up for that? I didn't. I signed up for bliss and understanding. Right? And the end to all problems. Was anyone similarly naive when you started? Right. I was looking at, I was interested. I looked at the Spirit Rock website to see how they greet, as it were, beginners in meditation. Or I should say how we greet beginners in meditation. And here's what I found on the website. Insight meditation is a profoundly liberating practice and path to genuine well-being, happiness, and freedom. It's good so far. Grounded in the foundational practice of mindfulness, insight meditation enables you to see clearly the truth of your inner and outer experience, providing insight into the ways you create your own suffering and how you can be free of pain and stress. Well, that's not right at the end. That's a little bit of false advertising. We can be free ultimately of dukkha, the reactivity, but not of pain. The Buddha himself, whoa, there's some deer who were not in pain went racing through the back of here. Anyway, there's a moment of pleasure in the midst of talking about pain and dukkha. Short-lived. So the Buddha himself had backaches when he was older and headaches. Did you know that? Yeah. He had backaches. You can imagine him sometimes saying, "Hey, Ananda, will you do the Dharma talk tonight? My back is killing me." I don't know if he said that, but he might have. But in any case, we don't get rid of pain and stress and difficulty. I think we know that. But what we can do is we can be develop through training and practice a wiser response. And, you know, I know that even small things sometimes throw us for a loop. Like about 2 weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had a cold sore on my tongue. And it was painful even to eat food or drink water. And it passed in about 2 or 3 days. But at least in my mind, it was kind of big while it was there. You know what I'm talking about? We want everything to be lined up so there's not any pain. So we're maybe a little bit pampered. Anyone call yourself a little bit pampered? You're used to things being smooth, right? Yeah, I remember, you know, maybe we've traveled in other countries, we realize the rest of the world is not like this. Of course, the rest of the country is not like it. You know, I know that, you know, where I found the most difficult situation was in the former Soviet Union. You know, far more difficult than when I was in Asia. You know, that in the former Soviet Union, toilet paper was very hard to find. Interesting. It was very, the conditions there were quite rough. Anyway, so last time I was here, last three times I was here, I gave a series of talks on non-harming. And one of the reasons that I chose this topic of working with difficulties is that I've had to work with my own difficulty in the last about 8 or 9 days. That and I thought to reflect some of that as well as look at the topic of working with difficulties generally. 9 days ago, someone broke into my house. And I'll talk as if the person was a he. I don't know for sure, but that's likely. And it was interesting because I sometimes go away for as many as 5 weeks at a time traveling and teaching. And here I was away for an hour. I went swimming. It was a very good swim. Very nice locker room conversation. You know, we have locker room conversations at my pool which are unlike the locker room conversations of our president. I think I was actually having a very interesting discussion about trauma. And then I came home, saw my front door was open, thought, I think I locked the door. And pretty soon I went in, the house was ransacked. Right? And I had just been away an hour, clearly it was an opportunistic theft. First time it's ever happened in my life, like something like that. I've had some petty theft at times, a few times, but not like this. And so it was first time. And I called the police, and they took about 3.5 hours to come, which wasn't great, but when they came, they were very good. The thief had broken two windows in my kitchen to try to get in. One was by the door, thinking he could just undo a latch, but that didn't work. So it broke another window, couldn't get through there because it was safety glass, and then broke a window in my bedroom, was able to get through there, but there was a lot of jagged glass, and he got cut pretty badly, so there was blood all over my house. Oh. There's, you know, on the floor, on rugs, on the bed, couches, everywhere. And I think person was in a hurry and I think was probably somewhat disappointed. Didn't find, you know, I didn't have drugs. Didn't have money. I did have petty cash, sort of. I keep it, had a little container with spare change, like pennies and quarters. That was taken. My computer was taken. Not so good. I had done a backup of it 4 days ago, but I'm working on writing the judgmental, transforming the judgmental mind books. I'd lost 4 days of writing. Could have been a lot worse. The backup disk was right next to where the computer was. If that was taken, that would have been pretty disastrous. Didn't happen. So fortunate in many ways. I didn't come home and encounter the person. My computer was 2009 MacBook Pro. Also took a 2002 computer. Took an iPhone 5. I looked up the pawn shop value on the internet, $10 to $50. So I think must have been very disappointed. I hope that the word is out. Not a good house to rob. But anyway, also took my day pack. This is a new pack. Very nice. And in my pack was a microfiche of an old Kabbalistic text that I picked up last year in Israel in the holy city of Sfat, where is the center of Kabbalah in Israel. Supposed to bring good luck. Maybe it did. Also, you remember my red meditation shawl and the green that was taken for some reason. Person sat on my meditation cushion. So there's some mysterious thing. I have some degree of humor about the Kabbalistic text and the meditation shawl. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there's some more valuable things there in the sense of what you can get money for on the street. Anyway, took the meditation, sat on my meditation cushion, dripping blood everywhere, and didn't take, I have a bunch of tankas and other things, those were not taken. So not too much was taken. I was thinking, I thought of a poem by Allen Ginsberg. He wrote a poem after he was mugged in New York City. I thought I'd read it, because it's a little bit the flavor of what happened to me. This is from 1974. Tonight I walked out of my red apartment door. I also have a red door. On East 10th Street's dusk, walked out of my home 10 years, walked out in my honking neighborhood tonight at 7, walked past garbage cans, chained to concrete anchors, walked under black painted fire escapes, giant cast iron plate covering a hole in the ground, walked past a taxi cab controlling the bottle-strewn curb, past young fellows with their umbrella handles and canes leaning against a ravaged Buick. And as I looked at the crowd of kids on the stoop, a boy stepped up, put his arm around my neck, tenderly, I thought for a moment, squeezed harder, his umbrella's handle against my skull, slowly appreciating, this is a raid. These strangers mean strange business. My wallet back pocket passed over the iron foot step guard and fell out, stole by God, muggers, lost fingers, strange. Couldn't tell, snakeskin wallet, actually plastic. $70, my bank money for a week. Old broken wallet, dreary plastic Contex Amex card and manufacturer's Hanover trust credit to business card from Mr. Spears, British Home Minister, drug squad, my draft card, membership in the ACLU, my Naropa Institute instructor's identification, Umahum. I continued chanting Umahum as this was happening. Shut up and we'll get out of here. And so they fled. As I rose from the cardboard mattress thinking, Umahum didn't stop them enough. The tone of voice was too loud. My shoulder bag with $10,000 full of poetry left on the broken floor. I'll say a little bit more about that, then talk more generally about how we work with things. I think there was some trauma. I had a sense of reality being very dreamlike for about the next 12 hours. It was an interesting state. I've noticed states like it in meditation, you know, where one kind of sees into the solidity of things. That was the way it was. And you know, it's been, I'll talk as I go through ways of responding to what's difficult. I'll talk about some of what happened, but it's basically, I think, a certain amount of anxiety, because the window actually is still broken. It takes about 2 weeks to get things fixed. And, I think there's some, I go out maybe and wonder, oh, when I come back, I hope no one comes in, right? So there's that kind of underlying tension or anxiety. And I'll mention other things related to it, you know. Like even last night I had a dream of coming home, the door open, and I said, oh, not again. That was a dream, you know, and I woke up. So it's, these things have an effect, you know, and a little bit like trauma in some way. So you know what the core teaching is about how to work with difficulties. What's the core teaching that I like? Anyone know? Well, it's the teaching of the two arrows, yeah. The teaching of the two arrows. This is it. Okay, this is the core guide. This is the concise guide to working with difficulties, right? You only need to remember one teaching. Okay, so what's the teaching? The Buddha is talking to practitioners, group of practitioners. He says, everyone at times experiences the unpleasant. So how is a practitioner different from a non-practitioner? They don't answer him. He answers his own question. He said, and he talks especially in terms of physically unpleasant experiences. I'm going to generalize to talk about all types of difficult, unpleasant, challenging, painful experiences. He says, everyone at times experiences unpleasant experiences. In this, the practitioner is no different from the non-practitioner. A non-practitioner means someone who is not practicing in the moment, so it can mean us when we're not practicing as well. So the non-practitioner and practitioner both sometimes have difficult physical experiences, pain, cold sores, sore toes, injuries, illnesses. And of course, we sometimes decline in health, and we all die, which can be painful. You know, what most people say they want is to die without pain. Most people are afraid of death, not because of not existing, or at least that's what seems to show, but because of the pain associated with it. That's what they find. That's what we find. So we all have physically painful experiences. We all have at times emotionally unpleasant or painful experiences, right? We have anger, fear, dread, despair, grief at times, right? Can be quite unpleasant. We have unpleasant interpersonal experiences. We have unpleasant and painful experiences related to the society. We may be treated unfairly, unjustly, oppressively, etc. And the practitioner is not different from the non-practitioner. So where the difference occurs is that on the basis of this pain, which the Buddha calls the first arrow, he says we are all at times shot by the first arrow. He says, because of the first arrow, non-practitioners tend to shoot a second arrow, we might say, at ourselves or at others or both, as if that would help. So physical pain, we tighten, we contract, maybe we blame ourselves, we blame someone else, all sorts of things. You know, people with chronic pain, most of the pain for a lot of types of chronic pain isn't the condition, it's the tension around the pain. It's the contraction around it. Very common. You know, and so I think I've mentioned sometimes the first application of mindfulness in the medical field was by Jon Kabat-Zinn, working with people with chronic pain. Because as much as 80% of their pain was the reaction. If you can bring it down to 20%, makes a huge difference, right? That was where mindfulness was applied. So we can also have, we can shoot the second arrow emotionally and mentally. We can be judgmental of ourselves or others. We can tell a negative story, make up a negative scenario. We know that, right? We know all the multiple ways that when we have emotional or mental pain, we can make it worse, right? And we can, of course, when there is a conflict or a difficulty, something painful interpersonally or socially, we can engage in conflict and, you know, react unconsciously and try to inflict pain on the other. That's what a large number of wars and conflicts are about. They are two sides shooting second arrows at each other, saying that we are the ones who are righteous. Right? So what to do? The teaching suggests we learn how not to shoot the second arrow, but rather to respond in a more skillful way. That's the teaching on an individual level. I like to interpret the nonviolence of Gandhi and King and others, Dorothy Day, precisely as the same teaching. We have received oppression. We will not simply pass on the violence or the pain. So it's a very high aspiration, right? So learn not to shoot the second arrow. Another way to say it in ordinary English is, don't make something difficult or bad worse. Very simple way to say it. Not easy, right? Because we have conditioned tendencies to make things worse. I heard from Sylvia Boorstein a very nice way of talking about it, that she learned from her grandson, who was at a Jewish wedding, where they were serving gefilte fish. Anyone ever had gefilte fish? I had it some as a kid. It was wretched. I really could not stand it. And so anyway, at this wedding, they were suggesting that you put horseradish on gefilte fish, and Sylvia's grandson came up to him and said, "Now I know how you can make something horrible worse." So that's the teaching. Don't make something bad worse. That's the teaching. Again, how to do that. That's what I want to talk about the rest of the time. How do we actually take a difficulty, and how does our practice guide us to not make it worse, to be skillful, to learn not to shoot the second arrow? Not easy. Again, I find that the most common thing I say to people I work with one-on-one, something difficult has happened, try not to shoot the second arrow. Most common guidance I give in everything I do. Right? And so it's huge. And I would say that this teaching of the two arrows is actually a more clear way of talking about the Four Noble Truths and about the center of the whole Buddhist path. Because I think that the first arrow we could call pain, and the second arrow we could call dukkha. If we make a technical distinction between pain and suffering, we could call the second arrow suffering. I like to call it reactivity. I think that's more accurate. It's not a good translation. It's not a literal translation, but I think it's clearer. So the aim of our practice, because I think pain and suffering are too often synonymous in connotation, and so the core of our practice is to, it's talked about as ending dukkha. I would say the core of our practice is to end reactivity. Another way in simple English is we learn to be responsive rather than reactive. Now, responsive sounds kind of simple and obvious, right? It's not. If we were going to unpack what being responsive means, it means having freedom. It means having wisdom and compassion. It means going to the depths of our practice. And so I think this is a way of talking about it. It gets a little confusing, even in the way the Four Noble Truths are expressed. I won't go into that so much, but you know, the first truth is that there is dukkha. Then the second truth is that the cause of dukkha is grasping, one form of reactivity. It's interesting because the first noble truth is about the unpleasant, so it's more, it's more something that we react to by pushing away. But then it says that the cause of dukkha is grabbing hold, so it's sort of, we have both, do you see what I'm saying? We have both aspects there. It can be confusing for people. So six guidelines for working with difficulties. Then this is my own list. This is not traditional. Made up yesterday. Fresh from my own practice. So the first is, I'm giving these in order. I think they could be in a different order. So the first is basically learn the transformative perspective. In other words, be oriented by a wisdom teaching. Could be the teaching of the two arrows. First is have a transformative perspective. Be oriented in your work with difficulty. Have some sense of how to approach it. Again, we could say, that we have an orientation where we're going to take the difficulty as part of practice. Another way to say we're going to take it as part of learning. Not so easy, right? Oh, I have difficulty. You know, as one of my students sometimes says, oh, another effing growth opportunity. Right? But can we do that? Can we take a difficulty as a possibility of learning? Or how often, when we have a difficulty, do we just want it to end? And practice and the desire to learn goes out the window. Right? Often, right? I just wanted my cold sore to be better. I didn't say, oh, a cold sore. An opportunity for practice. Yeah. One of the nice things about teaching is that I get to, say things that can guide my own practice, right? Because I'm not just up here talking to you. Sometimes I sit here and think, You should take in what that guy is saying. Okay. So take everything as learning. Not so easy, right? Take everything as practice. The Tibetan teacher Shabkar from, I think, the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th, says, let your life and practice be one. Not easy, right? How can we do that? Here are some, you can remember these, there are some very amazing Japanese Zen stories that take even difficulties as opportunities for learning. This is a story from the 17th century poet Mizuta Masahide. You may remember this. My barn, having burned down, I can now see the moon better. Or you may remember, here's another story. A Zen master lived a simple kind of life in a little hut at the foot of the mountain. One evening, while he was away, a thief sneaked into the hut, only to find there was nothing in it to steal. I think my place, there were some things to steal, but not enough. I think the person was disappointed, as well as injured. Not good. The Zen master returned and found him. You have come a long way to visit me, and you should not return empty-handed. Please take my clothes as a gift. The thief was bewildered, but he took the clothes and ran away. The master sat naked, watching the moon. Poor fellow, I wish I could have given him this beautiful moon. So we get some teachings and perspectives, right? So the second guideline for working with difficulties is develop and apply mindfulness. This is an obvious one for us. But I think what these guidelines are really suitable for any kind of difficulty, including even something like trauma, like even fairly intense trauma. So what mindfulness does, of course, is it gives us some degree of non-reactivity to work with the unpleasant and to work with our own reactivity. So mindfulness is an intervention that both gives us a certain degree of non-reactivity and also it lets us know what's happening so that we can bring in other tools, that we can be skillful. Mindfulness, so again, this is when something difficult happening, can we have mindfulness say, this is happening? You know, I'm getting tense, right? Or I'm getting reactive. So mindfulness is crucial. We call on mindfulness. And of course, in our lives, when I work with people, typically when something difficult happens, that's when they stop doing practice and stop being mindful. Is that familiar? Something gets hard or difficult or sometimes busy, and we stop practicing right when we need it, or the mind is more scattered. So keep on with the mindfulness. And we can be mindful of reactivity. We often say mindfulness of reactivity is not reactive. Mindfulness of anger is not angry. And we can also, with our mindfulness, start exploring the nature of the difficult experiences. You know, some of you know Gregory Kramer, who's a colleague, lives in the Seattle area, who developed Insight Dialogue. And he's working with cancer now, I would say. And he's really practicing with cancer. And we have several teachers who have cancer now who are also sending out their practice reports on Caring Bridge. And I just wanted to read this account from Greg about, think of this level of practice with that level of intensity. He says, I've had the opportunity throughout this last week to observe the body-mind in states of profound dullness and physical despondency and occasional states of uplift or clearness. The recovery from the surgery is gradual, and while the pain is far less than a week or two ago, the fatigue has been nearly continuous. In bed 10 hours at night, then still tired during the day. An hour or two of activity in a day, and the body is drained again. While I specifically turn attention towards perception, I notice that the shapes, colors, and whatever is imbued into the objects is dull and without dimension. The objects themselves are dull. The tone of phenomena is flat and drained. Even color is drained of color. Like there is green, but so what? And the green or the trees have no depth. So can you feel that commitment to mindfulness in the midst of cancer and chemotherapy? I find that pretty inspiring. Right? So profound difficulty bringing the practice there. Third guideline, learn how to come back to balance and non-reactivity after one is reactive. Very, very crucial. Notice oneself reactive. Sometimes the mindfulness doesn't bring one back to reactivity, so we have to have a repertoire of ways to come back to balance. Might be to take a walk, talk with a friend, listen to a Dharma talk, do something physical, and so forth. I found, for example, with my experience, doing regular physical things really, really crucial. I've been going swimming every day. It makes a huge difference in how I feel. And also, of course, talking with people. Very helpful just to air and keep things moving.
Could you repeat number three?
Number three is learn how to come back to balance and non-reactivity after one is reactive. So we have to have a toolbox and even have a little card in your, pocketbook or pocket or whatever that gives your repertoire, and you notice yourself react, okay, which one should I do? Right? So, but again, this is dependent on mindfulness telling us we're reactive. So coming back to balance, sometimes the reactivity is too much for mindfulness. Really, really crucial. So one of the teachings that I've developed is that it's really crucial to know the level of intensity of your reactivity. Know whether on a scale of, so I use like the diver's degree of difficulty, 1 to 10. Notice if it's a 5, if it's a 9 or a 10, you have to use strong means. Maybe it's a 4 or 5, you can do mindfulness. But ask about what that level is, one of the ways of coming back to balance, which is also very valuable in other ways, is to work with one of the heart practices, like loving kindness or compassion. One of the properties of these heart practices is they can be part of what brings us back to balance. Feeling really reactive, do metta. Do compassion practice. I've been doing this every day during this time, and I've noticed that I have a certain amount of compassion for the thief. I haven't got yet to forgiveness, but there's compassion, right? And I have a sense, very likely, don't know for sure, very likely someone maybe with early childhood trauma, certainly not a happy life, right? Don't know for sure, but large numbers of people are out there who have early childhood trauma, difficulties, and, the way they make their money is often by stealing. Right? That's true. And I was thinking that's also like a testimony about the society, right? That we don't take care of such people well. Right? Some other societies do. I've been reading this very beautiful book, powerful book. Some of you may know this, The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. It's about trauma. And it's magisterial. It's the comment on the front page says it's a masterpiece. I think that's true. And I thought I'd just read something that he said. When I go to Europe to teach, I'm often contacted by officials at the ministries of health in the Scandinavian countries, the United Kingdom, Germany, or the Netherlands, and asked to spend an afternoon with them sharing the latest research on the treatment of traumatized children, adolescents, and their families. The same is true for many of my colleagues. These countries have already made a commitment to universal health care, ensuring a guaranteed minimum wage, paid parental leave for both parents after a child is born, and high-quality child care for all working mothers in those countries. Could this approach to public health have something to do with the fact that the incarceration rate in Norway is 71 out of 100,000, in the Netherlands 81, and in the United States 781, so well over 10 times. while the crime rate in these countries is way lower than in ours, and the cost of medical care about half. 70% of prisoners in California spent time in foster care while growing up. The United States spends $84 billion per year to incarcerate people at approximately $44,000 per prisoner. The Northern European countries, a fraction of that amount. Instead, they invest in helping parents to raise their children in safe and predictable surroundings. Their academic test scores and crime rates seem to reflect the success of these investments. So this is a larger social issue, isn't it? And I was also reading something by someone I've worked with in meditation named Phoenix Soleil, who talked about working, is my sound? Yeah. Who talked about working with people in juvenile hall, you know, and she talked about going to a retreat and meeting a friend of hers who had a broken arm and a cast. And the person said, well, you know, I was mugged. And Phoenix, you know, right before the retreat, and said, I imagine that person was really hurting. And Phoenix thought of the people she worked with at the juvenile hall, and a lot of them stole. A lot of them stole because they wanted to get medicine for their families or just to pay for basic needs. And some of them stole for other reasons, and some of them didn't care, right? So it was a mix. But, you know, I think about that, you know, that that's part of where my mind goes in terms of compassion practice. So the fourth is inquire into reactivity and its roots. And this we can do by mindfulness, by really staying with the phenomena that we're working with, that we can stay and explore the reactivity that's occurring, or the difficult emotions, or simply the unpleasant. That the practice is amazing when we actually stay with the unpleasant. And I've experienced this probably most profoundly on retreats, where I've sometimes stayed with difficult emotions or difficult sensations for extended periods of time. It is incredibly illuminating just to study. You know, I, for whatever reason, had the benefit. I once had a retreat where I studied fear for 10 days. It was, luckily, it was always in the workable range. It was in the middle range, wasn't extreme. Another retreat, I studied anger for about the same amount of time. It was also workable. So fear and anger in these instances were happening all the time, and I could work with mindfulness. Pretty amazing to study that. Many of us, when something unpleasant occurs, or pleasant, study it in your practice. Really, really crucial. It's no coincidence that the Buddha named the mindfulness of feeling tone, or pleasant, unpleasant, as neutral, as one of the four foundations of mindfulness. This is one of the four areas to pay attention to. His reason was, when you study what your mind does with the unpleasant, you'll notice reactivity starting. You know, and the teaching is that there is a difference between the unpleasant and the not wanting it to be there and the pushing away. Three different steps. Often they happen bam, bam, right? But we can study this. Study, so when your meditation happens and something unpleasant occurs, study it, what it's like. Really a crucial part of our practice. And as we do that, you know, we can actually be with the reactivity. It's possible, and I've explored this sometimes in terms of the judgmental mind, it's possibly to go very, very deep as we study the unpleasant and our reactivity. We can go very deeply, both individually, into our own roots of reactivity, some of which also may be early childhood, may be our own patterns. We can study them and transform them when we go more deeply like that. Number five, shifting our center of gravity from reactivity to responsiveness. This is not so different from what I've talked with earlier, but at a certain point, we develop further practices, we cultivate equanimity, we cultivate other heart practices, and we eventually spend more time being non-reactive than reactive, more time with what we might call awakened qualities. And the way that practice works is we do that more and more, and something shifts in our being, so that increasingly we don't get so caught with reactivity. This is sort of a fruit. And then all of the ones I've mentioned so far have been more inner experiences. We're working inner practice, I should say. You can apply them to being with others or interpersonal situations, but they've all been sort of more meditative ways of working with difficulty. And then the sixth one, which I'm not going to go into in so much depth, is learn to respond more skillfully outwardly. So this would involve skillful speech, skillful work with conflict, skillful ways of being with interpersonal and even social difficulties, skillful work with racism, skillful work with sexism, and so forth. So that's a large area. I'll just leave it at that. Okay, but know that that's very important. So these six areas, let's see. Learn a transformative perspective. Develop mindfulness and apply it. Learn how to come back to balance and non-reactivity after one is reactive. Inquire with mindfulness and other means into reactivity and the roots of reactivity, and learn how to uproot those roots. Come to freedom. It's related to the five, shifting our center of gravity gradually from reactivity to responsiveness. That's the whole path, of course. That's what we're doing in a big sense. And then the part of it that I didn't go into so much depth on, learn to respond more skillfully outwardly as well as inwardly. So maybe I'll end and we can open things up. These are two great sort of one-liners from the Tibetan tradition. When the sun shines and the lights come on, when the sun shines and my belly is full, I look like a Dharma practitioner. But when faced with trouble, my faults are exposed. That's the first. And the second is very brief. Turn all obstacles into the path of practice. Turn all obstacles into the path of practice. That's it. Thank you. We'll have a question in a moment. Let's just sit for 30 seconds. So, Ron, please. We'll wait for the mic. Yeah. Yeah, very nice question. Yeah, the question is, in terms of the six guidelines, and the seventh was listening to a Dharma talk.
Turning it into a Dharma talk.
Yeah, that's, or turning it into art, or turning something difficult into something creative, maybe. Very, very good. I'll say that would maybe fit under coming back to balance, you know, different ways to come back to balance. So the interesting question of which of these, in my experience and maybe generally, might be used first. So I think the probably the first three especially. You know, the first, again, it could be that if there's a lack of balance, if one's caught in the reactivity, to find how to come back out of the reactivity. That seems crucial, right, initially. So, you know, I'm feeling really, really distraught by what happened to the point where I'm caught in it. I'm caught in blaming and judging myself or others or both. I'm really kind of feel really stuck in it. Well, if that's the case, then we want to have a way to be less stuck. And that might come first, right? You know, and of course we need the mindfulness to know I'm stuck, right? So it involves this is presuming we have some mindfulness training. So we can implement the mindfulness enough to know that I'm stuck, really, which, I think one of the techniques I learned from someone I trained with in body-based psychotherapy, a guy named John Eisman. Anyone know John? Yeah. He lives in Eugene. He teaches in the Hakomi approach to body-based psychotherapy, and really master therapist. And one of his methods was, he said, even when people are really stuck, it's almost never 100%. There's always some place that they're open, and he tries to find that place and uses a pivot to open up to get unstuck. Right? So I would say first to try to get unstuck, and that might mean, it might be done in a few different ways, might be to remember the teachings, might be, again, to maybe hear a talk or talk to a friend, and we talk to a friend that says, you seem really stuck, remember the teaching of the two arrows. Oh yeah, you know, something like that. So, you know, and then keep practicing, right? Keep practicing. I mean, I think for me it was really clear that I wanted to really just keep my regular practice going. And have that ways, but there's also something that some kinds of difficulties affect us at the level of the body and emotions a lot. And so I find something on a bodily level can be quite important at times. I found the vigorous swimming to be really, really helpful. Sort of washes things out. There's something, you know, it's like some difficulties are happening, at least for me. There's something inherently deeply, deeply pleasurable about that kind of exercise. And it feels very restorative, and it certainly cuts through that tendency. I mean, I used to have a practice. I would go to, when I was teaching in the graduate school, I'd go to faculty meetings once a month. They'd be like 6-hour meetings, and I had a regular practice immediately after faculty meetings, go swimming. So, thank you. Other reflections, questions, thoughts? Maybe examples of some of your own way of working? Can we wait for the mic? Yeah.
Like this? Well, I was just noticing for instance, I had something happen yesterday.
Yeah.
When my brakes went out on my car. Mm. Fortunately, in a safe place. And how quickly I let go of the sense of tragedy and dire upset, and just kind of, I was watching my mind first, kind of be really, irritated, and I was going to miss the event I was supposed to be going to, etc. But how quickly I actually let go of it, the mind just let go.
Yeah.
And for me, I think, I don't know how I got there. I didn't go through any steps or anything.
Yeah.
But I think it's good to notice, I'm more responsive than reactive.
That's right, yeah.
Because the more you really recognize and appreciate that mind state, I think it strengthens it.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you so much. I would interpret that as the fruit of your practice. And it sounds like that's how you're interpreting it. I don't know. Yeah. How many have had experiences where you found yourselves in some difficult circumstance and had a relatively non-reactive response that surprised you? Yeah. Look at that. Look around. Yeah. I remember I had something like that happen maybe about 30 years ago when I moved to California. I had been practicing at that point for 12 years. And my brakes went out on Interstate 70 at night, going through Kansas City on a bridge with no breakdown lanes. And I was in the fast lane. I knew it was dangerous. My car suddenly came to a stop, right? But there was something that I attributed as a fruit of practice, that I had really clarity and equanimity, and I just did what was wise to do. Got out of the car, got a distance from the car, and eventually someone volunteered to push me off the highway. But it was very dangerous, but I wasn't scared, and I was clear. And I was a little surprised by that, but I think it was a fruit of practice, and sometimes can happen. I think it's related to, as we shift, I use the language, we shift the center of gravity more towards responsiveness. That's a simple way of, you know, and not very apparently deep way of talking about actually becoming more and more free and, you know, coming out of our depths. Please.
Two things. One, I had an experience like that way before practice, and I had the clarity. You know, I think people do sometimes when things are in an automobile, almost accident.
Yeah.
But I had something last week where I had the same thing, only it was a flat tire.
Yeah.
It was kind of an explosive flat tire in a very safe situation. And I had the very reactive thoughts, but they didn't go into my body at all. So I had the thoughts and I just thought, yeah. Not going there.
Beautiful.
But they're there. But I think that's.
That's beautiful. It's again a fruit of practice. So
that is.
Yeah, it's not like the reactive thoughts necessarily go away, but we don't. It's just important. Thank you for bringing that up. Very important detail. We may still have the reactive thoughts. We just don't let them. What?
They have no reaction.
Catch us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have any juice. The reactive thoughts can keep coming, and we can look at this especially with, as it were, lesser things, right?
Yeah.
And just notice it, right? Notice the reactivity, but the mind doesn't take it and run with it, so to speak. And that's crucial. Yeah, and it's very, again, thank you for bringing that out, a very important detail. We don't totally get rid of reactive thoughts, but then we have some space in our minds where they're occurring, and we let them come and go. Yeah.